Accession number 30059, Reel 4.
Line up the trim tab, about 3.5 trim, and subfirm width. I could just see every now and then this all happened in about 35, 40 seconds. See the load begin to come up just a little bit, and all of a sudden came up like that. I was afraid that maybe I had put, you know, even just a little bit of trim tab, maybe too much of a strain, the wing would come off. Mexico, that's what I did. And I blacked out, and what I came to, I climbed about 10,000 feet going straight up. It's going so fast. Anyway, that...
thrill of what I've done. And you did that for a living.
Well, in a sense. In a sense. Total strength. It did increase dramatically as people, and I think as people began to realize what we were capable of doing in most instances, they also knew that we gave them no crap. You know, Dave Schilling coined a phrase that I can find it. I noticed it this morning was on here. He said, this should be your operational model. No bullshit.
That's very good. Nice Latin.
That was the secret. Yeah, nice Latin.
Nice Latin, I like that.
That was the secret. People realized that what came out of our outfit was straight from the shoulder. And Ben coined this...
That's good, too, but this is very good.
And this was my contribution down here. And that's the way we work.
That's very true.
That's the way we work.
That's
nobody,
good. Does Roger have that?
I don't know.
Have those? I'll copy. I'll write those down.
There were no fatalities directly. There were a couple of fatalities to people in the outfit who were flying operationally with some of the outfits just to find out what some of the problems were. But none directly.
Nothing like in testing.
No. There were some close calls, but there were a couple of airplanes burned up, pilots had to bail out, but no fatalities. Tricky times, but come on, Roger, number 19. Personally, I make close calls. Well, yes, everybody has some close calls. I got on those dive tests and trying to find out why the doors opened on the landing gear doors opened on the P-51 when it died. They'd come out and pull themselves off and tear a wing off. There were a number of close calls. How do you know?
Was that a... common thing on the P-51 for the...
Well, it was so bad that they finally put up lock on the... They didn't have up locks on the gear. They thought that the hydraulics would hold them in place. But it wasn't strong enough for the P-51. You dive pretty fast and get just a little bit of a wedge of air underneath the engine and you start to pull that thing to the camera. We put a camera... mounted a camera outboard to watch it, and I correlated that with the speed of the airplane. And I couldn't see the camera, but I had a little pin that I installed that I could see sticking up like that. When the doors began to open, the pin began to stick up straight. And the faster it went, of course, the more the pin stuck up. I also had a camera taking the pictures. which put up a lot of things themselves.
It actually pulled the wings off planes.
Oh, pulled the, first of all, it would pull the landing gear doors off. And in one case, it pulled part of the gear mechanism, and it came up and destroyed the section of the wing. Not the whole wing, the section the pilot got back. I'm not so sure that picture, with the bombs on the, that we looked at, that Jimmy saw, if that wasn't the thing we were doing, it may have been tricky times. I don't understand that, and you can tell Roger from me that you don't use that kind of terminology. I don't know what tricky times means. Did the 8th Air Force or command generals indicate their awareness of the value? That's ATS. That was one of our many names, I guess. ATS, I'd forgotten that. Air Technical Section. That was what it first was in the 8th Fighter. That's what Hunter called it. Oh, yes. We got all kinds of kudos from operational units, from commanding generals, from a stack of letters that you wouldn't believe, thanking us, and so they did recognize it. And an expert personal exert personal pressure to speed a particular object. The only one, the main one, was the belly tank for the B-47, Hunter, this special wrote us. I put every single person we could to work on that project. And in 2 months, which really, everything considered, was a pretty short period of time from start to finish for that particular job, which included a tremendous amount of engineering, a bunch of going and talking to people, like British Thermostat and Bowater Lloyd, and getting them to get the rag out and get moving on things for us, and flight testing, to make sure that we had, there were no hidden tricks with the thing. It took time. 2 months was it was a little less than 2 months. Actually, I think it was something like 54 days from the day that Hunter told me to do it, that the first ones were in operational use. I know I flew one 3 days after we got the tank, and then all these other modifications went on with it, but getting them made and getting the parts made and everything, I had nothing to do with that, of course. That was all General Hunter was riding herd on Air Service Command through 8th Air Force and everybody else. He could he get these things made, because as we would decide that this, like British thermostats, pressure relief valve, that this is what we needed, even though the project wasn't finished yet. That part of it was, and they could be given an order to produce these things. The same thing with Bowater Lloyd, producing the tanks, and the glass bits and pieces, and the shackles to hold the tanks on the belly of the airplane. It was a hell of a lot to do in 60 days, let me tell you.
It's amazing.
I just had a
with the questions or the answers to the questions, and then get on to the what else you found of injury. Okay, he says, where was the headquarters
of
TSD of M&RD?
Well, TSD is Technical Services Division.
No,
the name of maintenance, and I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Air Force Service Command. I don't remember the name of the base where Air Force Service Command
Now, they had a couple of them. They had one that dealt almost entirely in terms of materiel, almost a supply depot part of their operation, where they kept things that that the units in the field were badly in need of. Not a major depot, but and then they had their area where they were presumably trying to develop things, or not develop, but to improve things that were in the field. But they were run by a man by the name of Griffiths. I mean, the operation was run by Colonel Griffiths, this part of the Air Service Command. And he was jealous of anything anyone else did, extremely jealous, and did everything he could to put the shaft in. And anybody who had any ideas, if they didn't come up through him, they could be a product of his command, he was delighted. But if things took too long, I didn't want to, nobody in the field wanted to put the shaft in him.
Is that G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H?
G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H-S, Jack Griffiths. I don't know what his full name was, but I don't know what he became of him after the war. I have no idea. But I don't know what his official title. I don't remember what his official title was. The official title of the outfit that he commanded, I think it was Air Force Service Command, as compared to 8th Air Force Materiel Command. But where its headquarters was, I think it was Huntington, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Question number two, more information required on the extent of early bomber experiments at Bobbington. Now, there was very little done at Bobbington. That's where I think that Rogers made a mistake. There was very little done in the early days at Bobbington. Did they have anything they wanted to do there? They were running up against the same stone wall thrown up by Jack Griffiths and his Air Force Service Command. They did a few simple modifications. I knew nothing about it except that I had a little group in a Nissen hut and one large hangar over the other side of the field from the CCRC. And trying to figure out how we could make the P-38s better. And that was when I modified the P-38 after having my pants beaten off by Ted Smith flying the Spit 5 at Duxford, where Duxford was on the headquarters of the for the RAF. They did all their experimental work up there. And I went up there two or three times in P-38, and early on, this was in the early of 42, probably May or June, about June of 42. As I said, my butt was. Every time I tried, then I figured out what I thought might do a better job for the P-38 and did it. And then I went back there and worked the Spit-5 with it. And that opened the eyes of the RAF, who thought that the P-38 was no good for combat at all. Anyway, there's very little experimental work done at Bonington. Al Key was not involved there. Al Key came to my outfit directly from operational units.
From, you said, like, you mean like one of the bomber units?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You don't know which one?
No, I could probably find out, but at the moment I don't know.
Okay.
Rogers says that he was flying B-24 to the 44th Bomb Group in January of 43, and he stayed with that outfit until he came to my outfit. Now, when he came, I would have to guess it would be mid-43. I don't remember how many missions he'd flown by that time, but the number. And
well, in this, when it says that about the more information required about those experiments with bombing, were they being carried on elsewhere at any particular field other than bombing?
Well, Air Force Service Command was doing some. You see, CCRC was not a part of Service Command. I don't know. They reported directly to Director of Operations in the 8th Air Force, because all the combat crews, replacement crews, came there for training. And what little work they did on bombardment, unless Roger has some information that I didn't have. Excuse me.
Well,
He came from the I'd have to be the 44th Bomb Group, because Roger documents the group he was flying with in January 43, and he must have come in, I believe, in mid-43 that he came.
Mm-hmm. And he was not involved, obviously, in the early experiments, and that's maybe
that. Well, when he was with Miles, that he was, yes. What he did, I don't think he had any part of whatever work they were doing at Bobbing with the CCRC. I would get anything to do with it at all. And I think that, as I recall, we were doing nothing but work with fighters, because I was part of a fighter command.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember Al Key coming down to Fighter Command headquarters at Bushy Hall once to visit with me about some of the problems that they were having in the bomb group vis-a-vis fighter support.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to figure out, if there was anything to try, actually trying to figure out some way that the taking evasive action, the bomber itself could anticipate the pursuit curve into the attack. And of course they had a kind of computing gun sight on the armament on the B-24s and the B-17s, not a very good one. I don't have much information about that. I'll search my record for that. I know we came down there and talked about that. Was there any way that the evasive action could be, a new type of evasive action could be worked out? And then when Doolittle took over the 8th Air Force, and took my outfit right out of Fighter Command and put it in 8th Air Force, as part of 8th Air Force rather than 8th Fighter Command. It wasn't too long after that that L.T. came. I asked for him, because I'd gotten friendly with him before, and he had a good technical, a rough-ass technical background. He had no engineering background, but he and his brother Fred had won for the held the endurance record for years at Key Field in Meridian, in Mississippi. And so he had a rough-ass kind of knowledge of flying machines and what made them go. And he was a good man, because he wasn't cluttered up with a lot of engineering formulae any more than I was. And so I asked for him. He came. When he came exactly, I don't know.
And the third question is about you.
I stayed with the 1st Fighter Group in England until the 1st Fighter Group went to the south of England. Though actually they went to the Penzance area prior to takeoff for the to cover the November landings, the torch move in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down there with them. and stayed there with them. Went to Africa with them, came back, and that was my last part of my association with the Friday Review. Even in that time, I was back and forth between the first fighter group and fighter command headquarters. One minute I was a member of the first fighter group, and the next minute I was part of General Hunter's 8th fighter command, because that was the only fighter group in the theater at the time. And so fighter command and the first group were inseparable in a sense, the only operational group. And, when did I first go to Bobbington? Well, I don't know. February of 43, I had an office at Bushy Hall, but I also had this large hangar and a couple of buildings alongside the hangar at Bobbington as early as late 42. I didn't spend much time at the Bushy Hall. I ate there whenever I could because I had a wonderful mess. But I couldn't stand headquarters. It wasn't my job anyway. My job was with airplanes. It was strictly administrative. All I did there at nights, I know, was to... I worked on data that the British had given me from flying... And I had an opportunity to fly a couple of captured German aircraft, a 109 and a 190, to get some data of their performance. And I put together some data for fighter command units in respect of both particular airplanes, what kind of performance could be expected against them. So I didn't spend much time there, let's say, except to eat. And I slept there part of the time, although I did have a bunk in one missing hut at Bobbington.
But you were pretty much your own boss,
my own boss.
You just could move back and forth.
I was my own boss. I was out in the field whenever I wanted to be. I flew with other units whenever I wanted to. And General Hunter was very generous in that respect. He just said, "Do what you think has to be done, and on your own time, so to speak."
So it literally wasn't necessary for you to not only not show up, but to report in to anybody other than results of what you were doing?
That's about right. And once in a while, he'd ask me to come to a staff meeting and explain certain things to some of the stateside types that were that come over there to get a theater ribbon or something, which, you know, a lot of them did. I said once to General Hunter, and he laughed. I said, "Would you like you'd ask me about computing some speed curves or something?" And I said, "I'll tell you what else I'll do in my spare time too, if you'd like to." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Well, when I have a little time after dinner something, I'll sit down here and compute what I think should be the time required for a stateside officer to remain in the UK to get his theater ribbon. And I'll put all kinds of things into the equation. I'll tell you what the answer is." He never quite got a hold of that. He said, "Don't you dare say that to anything. These people that come over here." I said, "No, I'll leave it up to you to tell them." Ben went back to question number four. Ben went back to the States because while he was there for a month or so, it was during that time that I got so badly whooped in the P-38 by Ted Smith for AFDU, Airfighting Development Gear, AFDU Duxford. Ben stayed in the UK for not more than a month, but long enough to know how badly beaten I was by Ted Smith up at AFDU. Mm-hmm. And we conferred about what I thought was wrong with the P-38. he thought was wrong with the T-38, and I told him what I proposed to do. He said, I think that's the right track for it. He was the project officer on T-38s, and he was Mr. P-38 himself, so I had to get the feet of the master when I was talking to him about what I thought ought to be done with the airplane. He agreed, and he said, I'll go back to the States, and you just keep me posted on what you've done and how it affects the performance of the airplane. And the minute that it appears as something is good, I will see that it's put into production at Lockheed, which is an ideal thing. So I did the things that I thought had to be done. Some help from Langford Lodge with the Lockheed's service or modification center up there. But most of it was done at Bovingdon. Nonetheless, I flew the airplane, and I passed all this information back to Ben. That's when Jack Rivers and I began to get the tank, because I passed information directly back to Ben, and I guess they must have chewed on Jack Rivers' butt for how come that information got to Kelsey so fast without going through the chain of command. I'm guessing now, but I think that's probably what happened. Mm-hmm. He came out and read me out good, what I was doing, and I couldn't do this and couldn't do that. And I said, I'm not working for the service command. I'm working for fighter command. I'm working for General Hunter. You can talk to General Hunter. Hunter was probably threw him out of his office. When he said, well, when I need some help from service command, I'll ask for it. So Ben went right back to the U.S. And he came back to the U.K. in the middle of 43, which I think is when, Doolittle came to the UK to set up the 12th Air Force. They picked cadres from all the units in 8th Fighter Command to set up the 12th Air Force. And when he came back to the UK, which I don't know, I think it must have been in the middle of 43 or somewhere along there, to take over Ira Akers' job, he set up the operational engineering outfit. He called it operational engineering at that time, and I think somewhere in this list of questions is why did the name change so many times. But every time that Doolittle put a name to our outfit, he had a squawk from service command, because it implied that we were doing things that they should be doing, or vice versa. And I can remember his saying, this is going to be operational engineering, because that's exactly what it is. And apparently he was overruled in the States. It went that far. Apparently whoever was running Air Force Service Command, or whatever it was called, but the top materiel unit in the UK went directly to Arnold. He overruled Doolittle and told Doolittle that he could not call it operational engineering unless he wanted the outfit transferred to Air Service Command. And then, if I can remember, the teletype said, and that's what we recommend. And Doolittle said to me, no way is the outfit going to be transferred to Air Service Command. And I said, put me right back in another operational unit, because I won't work with Service Command. He said, yes, you will, if I tell you.
A little test of wills.
He said, I don't want you to go. I said, well, it's just the way it is. Was he in the UK between July 42, November 43, when he joined the 9th Air Force? No. I saw nothing of Ben Kelsey until he came back with the 9th Air Force, which was activated November 43. He didn't have any position. I don't know what position. He was a deputy chief of staff of the 9th Air Force when it was organized. That I know.
Well, if he wasn't in the UK, then that last question doesn't hold. Because it says if he was, what position did he hold? And if you didn't see him, he must have been in the States.
See, when the outfit, to answer the next question, really, we had a joint command, as nearly as it was possible to have a joint command. When Doolittle finally took this out, picked it out of fighter command and put it in 8th Air Force, and he called me one day and said, come have lunch with me, I want to talk to you what I want to do. And he said, Ben Kelsey ranks you, but I'd like them to be with you. And in the military, there's no way, you know, that. He said, I'll make a joint command, but on paper, Kelsey will be in command of the outfit. I said, I know what's down the joint. It doesn't bother me, because Ben and I are good friends, and I'll work for Ben. Or said, but you don't have to. You can work together, because Ben's not going to be there too much. And he said, I still conceive of Ben being here, being in the UK long enough to get the feel of some of the problems, begin to help with you, the two of you, begin to get your finger on some of the problems, then go back to the States, carry the message back there, and start getting things down there. And he said, I'll set that up properly. So that's the way the outfit started. And as a matter of fact, Pat, when Ben Kelsey's book, have you seen it?
No. It's in two volumes. It's going to be in two volumes.
It came out in one volume.
Oh, is it one volume?
Mm-hmm. It came out in one volume. And Carol sent me a copy. Well, Smithsonian and Carol together sent me a copy because it was published under the auspices of the Smithsonian.
Yes. Yeah.
When Doolittle got the draft of that book to write a foreword, it said in there something about Ben commanding this.